interpretations and viewpoints about what's really going on in the quantum world, the Copenhagen interpretation, the many worlds interpretation, and so forth. So we have an expert on that, one of our researchers, Dr. Hans Westman. He's one of our postdoctoral researchers, and he will explain and outline a number of the views we have, views and PCPs, and make things a lot clearer.
That's clear.
That's clear. I don't know what happened.
It's going too bad.
Oh, yeah, we need to have that checked out. And we need to have that. Oh, you need that up? Yeah. Actually, we can turn the light off. So, thanks. Oh, no. So, okay. So, Katz collapses and the nature of reality. So, Hans is originally from Sweden, and he did his PhD at the University of Gothenburg in the foundations of quantum theory. And do you want this one? Okay, I'll just keep talking. So, yeah. Great. So foundations of quantum theory. So let's turn that on. Great. So he also has done some work in general relativity and the foundations of general relativity and gravity. And so unfortunately, Sweden did not do as well as Italy in the World Cup. So I don't think we're getting photos of it. But Hans is a bit of a fitness buff, actually. I have to tell you. If you won't be embarrassed, but he runs marathons in his spare time. So if anyone's looking to run 30 kilometers tomorrow, then Hans is supposed to talk to
after the talk, right?
Yeah. So without any further ado, Hans Westman.
So today I got my, yesterday I got my code run. I've been programming for 2 weeks and got out of celebrating and came back 2 o'clock.
We understand.
So I'm going to talk about a little bit about the quantum weirdness. From time to time, maybe you see a little bit of speaker weirdness. So as a sort of an improvised introduction to the field, I'm just going to let you look at these guys and identify these guys. Because these are all persons who have thought very deeply about foundations of quantum theory.
Niels Bohr,
where? This guy?
Yeah.
More?
Heisenberg.
Right. We're not certain, though.
Yeah, it's also the principle coming on.
To the book. Sorry.
Fast.
Or Matt and Maxwell. Under really?
That's Pauli,
yes. John Bell.
That's John Bell, yeah. You look good over there. I'm going to shoot you right
here.
Where are we now? It was John Bell, and that guy's the same guy. This is David Bohm. David Bohm. I'm going to hear more about him in the last part of the talk. This is De Broglie.
Enrico Fermi.
Dirac. Who were the people who thought that quantum theory solves everything? Just grand theory, everything is perfect. And who are the people who thought that, you know, it's still problems? Einstein is one. Now the surprise here is only these three guys here, with possible exception of Pauli. These two guys thought that quantum theory was fine. All these guys here, sure. All the rest here thought there was problems with the quantum theory. So you get a little bit different picture now. These guys he's in this camp, Pauli, but he's also criticizing people. In fact, this guy is criticizing everybody. He's a very passive guy. There was one physicist who were talking with him, discussing his new theory with Pauli. And in despair, he, you know, cries out, "I don't understand why you call my theory stupid." And I was saying, "I'm not calling my theory stupid. So, and he's also, he's coining the phrase, your fear is not even wrong. So he's an nice guy. These two guys here, Bohr and Heisenberg, these are of course the founders of the Copenhagen School. They were disagreeing a lot, but they said that if we stay together, maybe we can fix this idea, which I didn't really agree with. But for Bohr, it was finally so that things doesn't make sense. It's not so that we have complementarity in a nice way. Complementarity means that you have contradiction at the most fundamental level, conceptual contradiction. An electron is an extended object, and at the same time, it's a point particle. That's sort of the view. At the same time, you could do that. So it's not that it's complementary in the ordinary sense of the word, it's actually contradictory. Heisenberg also fell into this sort of school. He said that tables and chairs are more real than atoms, which doesn't really exist. And people are, of course, saying, how can a table, which is made out of a chair, how can something which exists be made out of something which does not exist? That's a little strange. Einstein? Well, can you guess why I placed Einstein and John Bell here? And not everywhere. It's only because they have squares. That's in fact the reason why I placed them there. But, but there's also another reason which I thought about afterwards. I think those are the most clearest and demanding precision. Both of these are very much criticizing quantum theory. This guy in more modern times, and he's also very acid, and he's in fact the reason why many people are thinking about quantum foundations today. Einstein's going to be on the next slide, so I'm going to say more about him. David Bohm, first de Broglie came up in 1927 with a deterministic version of quantum theory, which worked. Nobody knows about it. This guy discovered it in 1952, and sort of this strange borderline scandal in physics that not more people know about this often. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in the end. Dirac was one of these guys who said that, he recognized these problems with quantum theory, but he said, it's too big for me, I can't solve these problems, I'm going to write down equations instead, I'm going to push physics in other directions. I think this is a very respectable position, because these are hard problems. I'm going to talk about what's called the measurement problem in this talk. It's not so that everybody has to solve the measurement problem. Physics is a huge, arena with lots of different problems, and you can make progress without solving other problems. But at least he recognized that there are problems in quantum theory. Then we have Schrödinger, and this is the famous guy for Schrödinger's cat. I'm going to talk about Schrödinger's cat, but in a little different way. I'm not going to have a cat. Of course, the cat is going to appear at some stage, but just once. But it's going to be the same thing, but now more serious in terms of laboratories and so on. We're going to see the same thing happening there.
So you dropped a Wigner's spring.
This guy's too small
for me.
Many people think that Einstein, he was old, perhaps a bit senile, didn't understand the new ideas. And I think this is very, very wrong. Schrödinger wrote down his Schrödinger equation, 1926, in the late 1926. In spring 1927, Einstein made two remarks. So this is just, by the time you get the letter in the post, like this new article, Einstein makes two remarks. Quantum theory does not yield classical behavior for macroscopic spots. Macroscopic spots are a good approximation. This is the measurement problem which I'm going to talk about. Second point, quantum theory leads to correlations among spatially separate objects that appear to violate action by contact principles. Action by contact really means that I cannot just hit him over here. I have to go to him and hit him. So I'm a very violent guy.
That's a real
yeah, so I cannot do it like this. And you have to scream, no? I'm not French, I'm Swedish. So actually by contact means that if I want to implement something, I have to either send a signal there, the speed of light, I have to go there. And Einstein is saying that there's something strange going on with quantum theory as formulated, as currently formulated. This is exactly what led to quantum non-locality paper. So, I mean, Einstein had different criticisms. This is his first gut reactions. Then he was later trying to criticize the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, saying that you know, quantum theory would have a way of going around it. That he failed with. But this part of his criticism is just to the point. It's very precise. And I think it's very wrong to say that Einstein, you know, he didn't appreciate the new ideas. Einstein also made a remark because he felt marginalized and, you know, not being listened to. He said that if I thought, you know, whatever amount of time I thought about general relativity, which is his theory of gravity, I thought 10 times as much of quantum theory. And that's probably true. So, this outline of the token, already spent a long time. I'm going to talk about classical physics in configuration space first. Configuration space is going to be one of these key concepts in this talk. We're going to understand everything. Classical physics through configuration space, quantum physics through configuration space. So this is going to be an important concept. What makes this quantum physics in configuration space? Then it's easy to see the measurement problem. What's bothering with quantum physics? And then we're just going to round off with different views. I'm just going to be rather short about this, just to give you a smorgasbord about you know, how you can think about it, if you can think about it that way, and so on. And then the conclusion, my talk. Some other person said Enrico Fermi, it was you, right? This is one of my favorite quotes. Never underestimate the pleasure of hearing something you already know. So we're going to talk about classical physics. Here's the idea of configuration space. How many of you are familiar with configuration space? One there? Good. It's a very simple. It's a very simple concept though. So suppose you have one particle. Well, what's the essence of a particle? It has a position, right? So you give a position. Of course we're gonna think in three-dimensional space. I have only two dimensions on this screen, so I will draw two-dimensional pictures, but it's sort of representing three dimensions. Yeah. So I give a point here. That point represents just a point in physical space. I move around, and the point changes position. This is just giving about three coordinates like that. If I have two particles, I can group these coordinates in triples, two triples. The position of the first particle, I give x, y, and z coordinates for that particle, and then I give x, y, and z coordinates for the other particle. Maybe it's over here. But mathematically, this forms a six-dimensional space because there are six real numbers here. So I can describe two particles, the position of two particles, but just one point in this space. Is this clear? Mm-hmm. Because I just, if I put my marker here, I'm getting numbers here for all these different things. And then I just read off the triples. And that's it, I'm getting the position of the two particles. So that's configuration space. N particles, I have the same idea. I just order things in triples, in N triples. So the configuration space is three dimensional, or N times three dimensions.
Now, would you look at a diagram like that and be able to visualize backwards too? You see one squiggly line and you see how three particles are interacting and moving?
No.
It's not just me.
This guy's fast. So, I mean, this is an abstract picture, but it's very useful. Give me one point there, and I'm getting the position here. Here's the visualization. I'm getting all these points here. Here's a different thing. So this is 56 points. I actually counted them. Not this morning, so it's actually correct. Here's a fifth one, when n particles, and I actually get smiled here, because that's all the point properties here. So you see, a point here in my abstract space corresponds to something in reality. I have an interpretation of my theory. I know what this theory tells me. Point is here, that's the reality, it looks like that, it's a smile. Of course, we're going to be a little bit more serious. So we can talk about, for example, a measurement apparatus with a needle like that. We're going to call this the calibrating state. And a point there corresponds to a certain position of this apparatus. So it describes all the particles in this apparatus. And in particular, it will, of course, also tell if it's in the calibrated state or perhaps some other state. So we, instead of using this notation, we can just exchange it for that notation. Why not? No. Also, if we replace it with this one, we realize that I'm not really saying exactly where it is, and I'm just saying something rather approximate. Something like this. Now I can move one atom a little bit over there, and it will hardly make a change to this picture here, but this guy is actually changing a little bit. So it's somewhere in this gray region here. Much. Here's a different configuration. I have an outcome, for example. The measurement needle says, well, it's 5 amperes now, or something like this. This is a measurement apparatus. Could be a voltmeter, ampere meter, whatever. And this, of course, corresponds to a different point in configuration space. And those are separate. So how do we evolve things in this theory? Now we have I'm going to call a state. Of the system. The state of the system is just a point here. That's my state. And that's what corresponds to things in reality. And this state can evolve in time. I give it initial values, and it evolves. It goes from this point down here. And these are just the Newtonian laws. So, for example, I'm doing an experiment, and I'm describing everything in my room, including myself. So, on everything. The whole system evolves according to these laws, and in particular, in the end of the day, my measurement needle will point somewhere. So we see here also that there's no problem in this classical physics describing everything. It has no problem. I'm not saying we have to describe this object, but not myself, because everything could be contained in this configuration space. Just include more particles, the particles of me, the particles of the computer, whatever you like to include, just include it. The whole universe, fine, no problem. And as soon as you give a point in that configuration space, I get a picture of reality, very much like this. So am I too fast, or is this?
No, this is good.
That's good. Now we're going to go to quantum theory, because now everything is completely understandable here, right? Just this configuration space, no problem. And it corresponds to reality. We have a clear picture of what's going on. Quantum theory. Now, what's really different? The good news is that we still have configuration space. You can formulate the theory in different ways, but one way is use configuration space. That's what we're going to use. We're going to sort of have a minimal opening into quantum theory. So we keep the familiar concepts from classical physics. The bad news is that the state is no longer represented by a point in configuration space. State in quantum theory is represented by a complex function, psi, and configuration space called the wave function. And now we start wondering. Well, at this stage, how many people have a clear picture? Yeah, I know what that means now. Right? There you go. You know?
Oh, no, I have no idea.
So that's also. I mean, this is the phase. What you should have at this point. How could you go from classical theory where things are so precise at the point corresponds to picture to something like this, a complex wave function? So let me first explain what a complex wave function is. I mean, so a wave function is just a machine, something like this. Give me a point, x in configuration space, and I'll give you a complex number, a plus r b. So I'm just pointing to different points in configuration space, and I get a complex number. Here it's zero, here it's a different number, here it's a different number. So for each point, I have a complex number. And that's just my state. And now I realize there's something strange going on. How? What is this new object? Each point here represents something, you know, like a needle being here. And I have a complex wave over a whole space. Quantum theory you can do for different systems. You can do for one particle, then the configuration space is just three-dimensional, and the wave function, of course, leaves a three-dimensional space. If it's two particles, the configuration space is two times three dimensions, it's six-dimensional, and this is the coordinates, and the wave function lives on that space as well. If you have m particles like that, then the wave function lives on three n-dimensional space, n minus three dimensions. Now, physicists like to extrapolate everything. Oh, I found a theory, you know, for small systems. Let's extrapolate. Let's assume this theory works at all scales, for everything. Universe, me, everything. So we're going to assume that it applies to everything. Even macroscopic bodies and not just atoms and electrons. Normally the way you talk quantum theory is that this is a theory for small things. But then you're going to say, hey, is this a fundamental theory? If it's fundamental, it's supposed to be, I'm supposed to be able to use it to describe me, cans, stones, and so on. So I was raising the issue, how are we supposed to think about this theory? How do we interpret this wave function? So let's be physicists again. We simplify problems and, you know, make ansatz and do things that seem intelligent. So assume that you have a wave function that is peaked around some point x in configuration space. What I mean with peaked is that it's zero over here, and here the wave function takes on non-zero values. So it takes on values like that, for example. And then since we know that this point corresponds to something like that, well, this region here will be sort of not too dissimilar to that. So maybe a peak wave function, which is centered around the region here, is not too bad, because all these points here will sort of correspond to macroscopic objects in that position. Okay, maybe I don't know precisely where the second atom is. Maybe it's, you know, in a superposition being here and there or whatever. But that's okay, right? It's small. Here's a different one. When I have a state here that corresponds to that thing, and well, then the wave function is zero over here, especially there, but non-zero there. We have to put superposition for it. Now we're going to get into more and more problems with quantum theory. I'm going to tell you a story which is very, very precisely the way a theoretical physics understands the problem. So I'm not going to teach you here. There's one principle, superposition principle one. We're going to use another superposition principle two in quantum theory. This is the first one. And if I have two states that are possible quantum states, then also there is sum. So I just take a complex number, psi plus another complex number, psi 2. This entity is also a new state. But this is problem sum now. Because if this is a possible quantum state, something like that, and that is a possible quantum state, then the superposition principle says that there is some. It is a possible quantum state. What does this sum mean? You went through the double slit experiment, right? Where the electron could be here and there at the same time, because the wave function was non-zero here, and the wave function was non-zero there. And you said, well, this corresponds to the electron being here and there at the same time. Well, quantum theory tells you that this is true for macroscopic objects as well. This is a possible state. Here and there at the same time, that outcome, or calibrated state, plus that reading at the same time. So doesn't make sense. So maybe we should rethink here, you know. maybe the laws of quantum theory will make it unlikely for these strange superposition states to occur. Perhaps if you start from a peak state, the state will almost never evolve into a state which is not peak. So this is not the peak state. This guy is peak, and this is peak, but together, of course, it's not the peak state because it's here and there at the same time. So maybe if you start from one of these, it will never move out into these states which are not peak. And then we sort of understand this theory because it will forget about this part here. It will always be around here. It's a little bit fuzzy in the details where all that, so, but that's okay because maybe that's not something I can measure. So this is the idea that perhaps quantum theory will only allow small objects like electrons and atoms to be in strange states of being here and there at the same time. And this is what seems to happen in the two-slit experiment. And that's sort of fine. I mean, small objects might be strange, but big objects are not really strange, right? We have experienced how they work. So let's investigate this. What does quantum theory tell us about this? So this is now I'm going to present you what's called a measurement problem in quantum theory. And I'm going to present you how you think about measurements in quantum theory. For simplicity, I'm going to talk about the spinning particle. This is just, I could take a different example. I had grand plans for this talk in the beginning. So I plan to talk about Bell's theorem, spin correlations, and so on. That's why I had a spinning particle. But then I realized that in order to make the talk self-contained and precise, I can only include half of the talk. But so here's the remnant of all that grand illusion. Here's a spinning electron, and you can think of it as a particle which just spins around some axis. That's not precisely the truth here. But let's imagine, let's just believe that that's the case. We represent the quantum state of this spinning particle spinning in this direction. This is a Stern-Gerlach apparatus. This is a magnetic field, and because of the magnetic field, the particle, if it's spinning upwards, will be deviated upwards. It will knock on a screen here called a scintillation screen, and that screen will give a flash, and we know exactly where it is, the particle. So this is what we know. If I prepare the state like that, it will go up if it's spinning upwards. There's also some, this is supposed to be inhomogeneous magnetic field, that's why you have to make them magnets like that.
Why does it have to be inhomogeneous?
Inhomogeneous.
Yeah, why does it have to be inhomogeneous?
It's, otherwise you get zero net force on this particle, even classically. So, that's the short answer. If you have this state instead, the particle spinning down instead, then it's going to go down and flash down. Now, of course, no experimentalist would like to sit around and count the flashes off, so we just pick up some camera here. We're going to detect if it's there or there. And we're going to connect that to our nice measurement apparatus over there. So we prepare this state here, spin up. The particle comes in, zoom, goes up, the camera gets it here, goes over here, and this thing here turns from calibrated state to saying, hey, it's spin up. So this state here means it's spin up. So we sort of revealed, the property of that electron. If we prepare it with this state, spin down, it's going down the camera, it goes down here, it's a flash. The camera will then see that it's not coming from there anymore, it's coming from there. And it's telling this guy to point in another direction. That's a nice measurement or experimental setup. If we have our nice device, we just look at it, and it records the outcome for us. We can take a coffee break while this is happening, go back and have a look at it. So we set up an experiment. And we would like to set it up in this way. Here's the calibrated state, and here's the preparation of this electron in spin-off state. Then things should evolve into this. This is what we require. That this is perhaps spin-off, and this guy is telling us he was spin-off. This thing here, if it's spin down, evolves into that. Superposition principle two. This is about evolution. The first superposition principle was about states, possible states. If that is, if one, this is a state, possible state, and this is a possible state, I can take the sum of those two. And it's also a possible state. This is about evolution. If I have, if I know the evolution of these state vectors or wave functions, as they're also called, I know the evolution of that one and that one. And that's really a devil to calculate this. If it's many partners involved, it's not even, if it's more than six partners, you cannot even do it on the high-speed computers. So, but if I know the evolution of that, then the sum will evolve according to that law. So you just replace psi 1 with phi 1, psi 2, and phi 2.
And the constants are the same?
The constants are exactly the same, do not evolve at all. This is a very simple thing, and this is a superposition principle too. But now we're going to get into the measurement problem. According to superposition principle one, this is a possible state, right? This was, if this is a possible state and that's a possible state, then the sum is a possible state, right? This is not a strange state, because macroscopically it's sort of describing the same thing. It's a calibrated state, and again, it's a calibrated state. It's only in the microscopic details which we have some superposition and strange state. This is fine, right? I mean, maybe, you know, microscopy is not that, you know, well-defined and so on. So this is sort of, I mean, it's still a peaked state. That's what I'm trying to say here. Still shifting configuration space. So it's still something we understand or to think about. This is something roughly corresponding to microscopic to measurement needle being like that. And these states are routinely created in laboratory, so there's no question that we can create such states. This is something we have perfect control over, theoretically and also experimentally. But now superposition principle two is telling us this. I know how this evolves, because that was what I was talking about before. It should evolve into that state. And that thing here should evolve into that state. But since I have a sum, superposition principle two tells me that it should evolve into that state. But now we're in trouble, right? Because this is superposition of macroscopic distinct state. It's superposition of the measurement of our office showing this outcome and the measurement about showing that outcome at the same time. So to go back, by allowing these states that there's some superposition in microcosmos, we're getting superpositions in macrocosmos as well. Object being here and there at the same time. Of course you might object and say this is strange, right? When we do our experiments, I never see these things. I never see the apparatus in a strange thing in superposition, right? I see it either there or there. I don't see both. So what is quantum theory telling me here? Is there something wrong with quantum theory? Well, here's sort of a summary of what I would like to say. In a quantum experiment, the state will in general evolve into strange superpositions for macroscopically distinct state. According to quantum theory, that's normal. It happens all the time. Every time somebody does an experiment or something that's sort of like an experiment, this will happen. According to quantum theory, it's not only electrons that can be here and there at the same time. Also macroscopic objects like measurement equipment and human beings. No? And here are my cat slides. So this is, what I'm telling you is just another version of Schrodinger's cat. And more, which is a little bit more, I mean, here you have to worry about the cat's mental states, and you add more things to the discussion. And I'm more dry, right? This is just mentioning apparatus. No mentality. You don't need to agree. But But of course, Schrödinger was having fun with quantum theories, so he included the cat. So now we're going to present different reactions to this. And this is, I highly recommend for you teachers, shut up and calculate the interpretation. I have to say that even though it sounds funny, I have respect for this interpretation. This is sort of the opinion of Dirac. Well, not really, but I mean, you don't need to solve every problem. You know, there's a big problem there. Shut up. Develop physics in other directions. Of course, there's some people say that this is just bullshit thinking about these conceptual issues. You shouldn't do that. I think that's sort of a naive view, because if you look at Einstein, he was just having tremendous success doing these things. He was thinking deeply about freely falling bodies and developed whole theory of gravity. So it's not clear that it's just a waste of time to do that. But it is completely respectable to say that this is a problem, I'm going to work on something different because I don't understand how to deal with it. Then we have the Copenhagen interpretation, stressing that everything is conceptually contradictory. There's a limitation to what we can understand. We have our macroscopic frame of mind, and we cannot really understand microcosms. This is a von Neumann-Dirac collapse interpretation. We have superpositions. Well, take away one, right? It's the easy solution. There's many worlds saying, take this seriously. There are two worlds. A different outcome. This is quantum information interpretation. Don't worry, it's all about information. This is hidden variable interpretation, which I'm going to talk about with you in the last case. Of these interpretations, so this is my opinion, but I think also it's mostly agreed. Only these two are sharply defined. The collapse interpretation and the hidden variable interpretation. We physicists don't like vague language. So if you talk, you should always give the precise mathematical equation. As soon as we spot some guy saying, you know, what, we're going to come into vague language here. So one thing I have to say is, precision is a lot of stake here. If we have a solution to this problem, I want the solution to be precise, mathematically precise, not in words, because then I'm not sure what's happening. So this is the Copenhagen interpretation. And according to that interpretation, the world should be divided into two parts, the quantum system, what one is measuring, and the classical apparatus that is doing the measuring. The quantum system should be treated according to quantum theory. So that should be rolled according to the Schrödinger equation. The apparatus should be treated according to classical physics, which is a completely different physics, right? Different laws. The interaction between the quantum system and the classical system is regarded as unanalyzable. One cannot give a precise scientific description of what's going on in the measurement process. One cannot and one should not. That's also a big word in the Copenhagen interpretation. You should not, you're not allowed. But here are the problems with that. I mean, Bohr was a great guy, but let's be skeptical. How do I know what is a quantum system and what is a classical apparatus? A classical apparatus is made out of atoms, right? There's nothing strange with it, it's not a holy object. So how many atoms do I need in order to be sure that it's a classical system? 10 atoms? No, probably not, right? 60? No, you're doing interference experiments with buckyballs and all these complicated objects. So you have to have more atoms, right? So here's the question of precision. If I have a division in my world, this is classical, this is quantum, well, tell me what you mean. Well, where is the dividing line? What is supposed to be classical and what's supposed to be quantum? Unless you make that clear to me, you're not saying something very clear. There's no satisfactory answer given by Bohr here. And also, I have personal, you know, mixed feelings about it, because it's in the mentality of you shouldn't do that. in particular, we should analyze, I mean, according to the Copenhagen interpretation, what went wrong in the measurement problem was that we analyzed the whole thing, both the quantum system and the big experimental apparatus, quantum mechanically, and tried to give a scientific description of it. And we say you shouldn't do that. And then isn't it non-scientific to claim it's scientifically impossible to analyze what happened during the measurement process? I mean, I'm a physicist, I'm curious, and this is my job. I analyze things. Why am I not allowed to do that? Here's a different interpretation with von Neumann and Dirac. They said that, okay, you get into these strange superposition states of outcome like that, superposed with a different outcome. Well, then of course we should just collapse it, we should take away one of these two. And then we end up with either that state or that state. And both of these states are sort of nice, and you have a nice interpretation for understanding what it would mean. So here's your wave function. It's peaked here and it's peaked there. So it's in a superposition like that. And the collapse takes you either to that thing or to that thing. Of course, here we have to raise exactly the same problems as before. If the wave function collapses, then when is this supposed to occur? How big must a classical apparatus be in order for a collapse to occur? And where are the mathematical equations that tell me exactly how and when the wave function collapses? Well, of course, these people are recognized as problems. And this has been developed. They have developed precise mathematics, how to collapse the wave function, when it collapses, how often, and all these kind of questions. You can actually do calculations. This is a theory due to Perl, Rimini, Girardi, Weber. This is a modified quantum theory. It's no longer a quantum theory. In fact, it's violating superposition principle 2. So this is a new theory. It has experimental, new experimental predictions, which are different from quantum theory. So already here, it's sort of interesting because it gives experimentalists the job trying to see, is this correct, this collapse theory, or quantum theory? There's some strange thing going on. Energy is not conserved. If you take the original theory, you compute how much energy which is produced from Big Bang to now, you will see that there actually are a little bit amount of energy produced, but it's tiny amount, something like 10 grams or something like that. And we could live with that. It's not so strange. When you try to make these theories fully relativistic, you get infinite energy production per unit time. But each moment of time, you should have infinitely much energy produced. And that's a big problem. So I have a tenth of a gram produced for the whole age of the universe. It's not a big problem. But to have infinite energy production per unit time is a problem. But if you say that, I don't really believe in special relativity, one can make all more relativistic ones, and these are fine. So you may also see the difference of the problems I'm raising with this theory. These are now very exact questions. I'm computing the energy production. It's non-zero. Now it's more like physical questions. It's not conceptual questions at all. And that reflects that this theory is a precise theory. It gives you predictions. So everything is okay? You understand that what I'm doing? Yeah?
Damien claims that quantum theory is the most successful theory in physics, that it's the most verified experimentally, yada yada yada. Are you suggesting that possibly this modified quantum theory could replace the most successful theory in physics?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, these types of theories are criticized. Like this. They have a free parameter, a new constant of nature, which is telling how often things are collapsing. And they can put that thing to any value they like. So if you see experiments, I mean, if you put a certain value of this parameter, you see that, well, it should violate the quantum theory for the double-slit experiment. But we have tested that experimentally. So that theory with that value of the parameter is just wrong. Then they shift the value of the parameter. Oh, I'm predicting that for buckyballs, you won't see interference. if you do the experiment, you still see interference. They're pushing the parameter once more. Now they're doing, you know, superpositions of billions of electrons going this way, still superposition, or you still see interference. And they push the value like that. So that's the criticism against it. But it's a valuable thing to do. I mean, it's good to have a foil against how you can test your theory. You make a new theory just for that purpose. So it's already here we're doing something good, and it's normal science to do so. And also, if you combine quantum theory, special relativity, and gravity, you get a mass, which is called the Planck, which is called the Planck mass. And that's roughly the mass of a grain of sand. Maybe that's the limit. Maybe you do experiments with this amount of mass, this theory takes over. Something like that. Many worlds. Let's take quantum theory really seriously and fully accept these strange superpositions. This is an action description of the world. And you're complaining, I don't see that in my laboratory. I don't see superpositions of Newton being here and Newton here. Well, let's analyze, let's say. Let's be careful. You have forgotten yourself in the descriptions. Here's you. Who wants to be this guy? He's looking at you right now, but he's also looking at this thing here. So here's the preparation. We're sending in such a state. It's coming here. Boom, it goes up. And this guy's very happy because he just made a bet with another friend that he would go up. He's not very happy because it was a different state. It went down. Camera detects it's in the down position. Oops, this guy should actually be like that, and that guy should be like that. Sorry, I missed the is that clear?
Yeah.
And then, according to our previous rules, how to think about quantum theory, this is how I evolved it. Here's a happy guy, calibrated state spin up. Here's a happy guy, calibrated state spin up. And according to superposition principle 2, that's how it should evolve. And now you say, oh, I have a complete nice explanation why I only see this outcome here. Because perhaps I'm that guy, and I'm seeing that outcome then. In a different world, I'm a different guy, and I'm seeing that outcome. So this is not one me, there's two me. And both of these have different perceptions. So this is very wild, of course. What are the problems? One of these problems, so in all of these talks, I never talked about quantum statistics. One of these essential features of quantum theory that is predicted probabilities and statistics, statistical regularity. I haven't talked about that at all. But this is one of the features which is damn difficult to understand in this theory. Why is that we see quantum statistics? For example, suppose this guy here is happy, but this guy becomes so sad, shoots himself. Or maybe when this experimental device, you know, triggers a mechanism that shoots him. Would you like to do this again? I mean, if you're really serious about many worlds interpretation, would you like to do this experiment? Well, so I'm going here. One guy is surviving, the other guy gets shot. Just replace this with a dead smiley here. Would you like to do that experiment? Why not? I mean, you're surviving. Always one guy is surviving here. But why do you have a problem with doing that experiment? There's another guy, which is not really you now, who's just dead. In another universe, parallel universe, why do I care? Right? According to this, I should freely go in and into Russian roulette game, triggered by a quantum mechanical mechanism. Just do it, right? I'm always surviving. There's nothing that will make all of me die here. One will survive, I'm happy. So, how do you think about probabilities? Normally we say, well, you have probability half-half of being dead or alive. This theory is saying, no, you have probability one to survive. It's just that you're a duplicate. There's another one to die. But you, who's also here now, is alive. So how do you understand probabilities here? If all the possible outcomes occur, how do you understand probabilities? It's not an easy question. this is also a technical problem called preferred basis problem. This is basically how do we identify different worlds in the wave function? How could I really, this is just a cartoon picture, but how do I separate out this part, which is one thing in the wave function, and that thing here? That whole thing is something which is a complex wave function on configuration space. How do I actually, you know, divide it up and say that that part of the wave function, so this is that part of the wave function, that. And also, what are we doing scientifically here? We say that part of the world, but per definition, I can never see it. So it's a little bit strange. And apart from that, there are all these parallel universes. Then we have the information theoretic interpretation of quantum theory. The wave function does not describe actual reality, but only the knowledge of an ideal observer. And when an observer obtains information about the system, he updates the state. So the collapse, you know, is just an update. It's a passive thing. It's something the observer does in his mind. If I throw a dice like that, I haven't looked at the dice, it's a probability distribution, sort of a state. It could be 1, could be 2, could be 3, could be 4, could be 6. When I look at it, actually it was 3. Then I update my probabilities, because I know definitely it was 3. And that's just the collapse here. So what are the problems with it? I mean, it seems like an attractive interpretation. Of course, it's all about information when you say that. Sounds very nice, and then you think, well, hang on. Normally information about something. So what is, well, you have some knowledge. Knowledge about what? Is it knowledge about the outcome of the experiment? Okay, let's pursue that idea. Okay, but if you're claiming to say something precise, you better specify exactly what you mean by an experiment. Is it perhaps an interaction between the classical apparatus and the quantum system? Is that supposed to be an experiment? And we get back to the same problem with the Copenhagen interpretation. The problem with this information theoretic view is that we're saying, I have knowledge, and you just forget to say about knowledge about what. And if you try to say knowledge about what, that what has to be mathematically precise. It cannot be about big objects. That's not a good answer. So again, here's the question of precision. The Broad-Bloom theory, this is the last one, hidden variables. So I told you in 1927, De Broglie came up with the deterministic alternative to quantum theory. It was rediscovered in 1952 by David Bohm and reproduced quantum theory. So this theory. Einstein's reaction to this theory was, I think it's too cheap. I agree with that. But it's something which works. It's no technical problems with the theory. And it's something which reproduces quantum theory. So it's worthy of attention here. It also gives a rather different idea of what's going on. So let's do something very cheap. If I cannot interpret that state here, let's just put in something extra in quantum theory. Let us put in an exact configuration, exactly like in classical physics. In classical physics, the state was evolving like that. It was a definite thing going around. Let's assume that quantum theory is lacking here. Let's assume that we're supposed to add an extra precise configuration, exactly what we have in classical physics. So a system is then described by the state and an exact configuration like that. That's the whole thing. In classical physics, this point of x in configuration space have also according to Newton's laws. This theory is not classical physics. It's a new theory where this x evolves according to new laws of physics. So here's a two-dimensional box. Here's a wave function. I plotted just the modulus square of the wave function. Looks a little bit like that. This wave function will evolve according to the Schrödinger equation. Here's a particle moving around in the box. So So if you look here, the wave function is determined in the motion of particles. So this is something how we get. Now you see again that this is sort of, we're doing something precise, it's mathematics, everything is, I mean, everything now is sort of like a Newtonian theory again. Go back to this slide. Now we know exactly how to interpret this theory, because we have a point here in configuration space, and that point will correspond to something in reality. And we have no problem whatsoever to understand what this theory is telling you. The point will occupy one of these things, states, these peak states. It will be either there or there. So we see our measurement apparatus here, because the point is there. The state is in the linear superposition, but the point is where? It's in one place, and that corresponds to what we see. So again here we have something which is very much like classical physics in the respect that we know how to understand this theory, what it says to us. So these are good news of the theory. It's completely well defined. It's even deterministic. Normally you hear that quantum theory says that determinism has been thrown out. This is not true at all. It's possible to make deterministic theories like this, which reproduce all of quantum theory. And recently also, and I was involved in that work, you could do modern physics with this theory. This is the theory I've been working on. The superposition principle is still valid. Also, this is interesting. De Broglie-Bohm theory is a much richer theory than quantum theory. And I will be using some words, which I may not be explaining. Quantum theory is sort of an equilibrium theory in this theory. So it emerges through a relaxation process. It explains the quantum statistics as a feature of quantum equilibrium. What are the problems? As I said before, this is an exact theory. It doesn't have these conceptual problems as other interpretations. So it's a strange way of making a theory. According to this theory, there are two things that make up the world. The particles in three-dimensional space, that was the point in configuration space which corresponded to all these particles and all these positions. And number two, the wave function which lives in three-dimensional configuration space. There's sort of two different arenas in this theory. One is what we know, and the other is a huge big space for configuration space. The wave function is fundamentally unobservable in this theory. The world we see is represented only by the configuration x of t, just as in Newtonian physics. We never see the wave function according to this theory. So then you may rightly complain to this theory, because suppose I have two theories. I have a theory why the moon orbits Earth. I have two theories about that. One theory is just is Newton's laws. The other is saying, it's an angel out there pushing moon, but I can't see angel, that's it. You're not very happy with the second one, right? Because if you say there's an angel out there pushing, you would like poke him and you say, that's what you, I mean, as a physicist, you would like to see the causes of things. You wouldn't like to explain something in terms of another thing which is you can't see. That's basically the problem of this theory. I don't show the double slit experiment here, but of course it's just about trajectories. It's about the particle going through one slit and ending up in certain positions, and you get these interference patterns after a while. But the reason why it avoids certain places and likes other places more is the wave function, because the wave function goes through both slits in this example. But the wave function you cannot see. So it's like this angel here. The particle is something which is observable. The wave function is the angel which is guiding, pushing the particle around.
Do we really need to know that? I mean, it's like talking about the wind. You can't see the wind, but you can see what the wind is doing. Do we really need to know that?
Well, I know how to manipulate the wind, and I can see the wind, first of all. I just shift my frequency spectrum a little bit, and at the infrared, the air is opaque. I don't see much. Mm-hmm. And possibly I can also see if there's a wind going in this direction, that will be Doppler shifted, and I could actually see it at those frequencies. So I would disagree with that, you don't see the wind. I mean, okay, the human eye doesn't see the wind. But for scientists, you're sort of using more of things. I mean, like,
so we're just unsatisfied because we can't.
In this theory, it's postulated that you cannot see. Right. It's sort of part of the theory. So
I'm wondering in what way the wave function observable in, say, quantum theory. I'm not clear on what that really means. This says it's unobservable, but in what way is it observable in the other theories?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, so this is very much the state of the quantum theory. Most people don't think much about it, and they talk about observables and so on, and then you're saying, well, there's only one object in this, it's the wave function. Is that the thing I'm seeing? And then they're saying, I don't know about that. I haven't thought about that. When you go into foundations, you start pushing these issues, and you come into theories like this, and then you start thinking about these issues, and you get precise answers. In this theory, configuration is what I see, the wave function is not observable. Quantum theory is not clear about these things. And that's precisely your question.
In other words, I find that it has the same issue behind it, the same underlying problem, mm-hmm. because you can't see the wave function there. All you can see is what it can predict. Mm-hmm. But if this is exactly the same thing, then I'm having a hard time saying what the fundamental difficulty is with what's the problem that's being presented.
The standard view of quantum theory is that they haven't made up their mind what to think about things. But if you're pushing them really hard, maybe they would say something like this. I believe the wave function is what you see. I'm contradicting what you're saying. And they would actually go into the many worlds interpretation. Because in the many worlds interpretation, this is what corresponds to reality. And the wave function is sort of what makes up this guy's mind, what he's seeing and what he's doing. So if you would like to understand what quantum theory, quantum predicts, what I'm feeling, what I see, and so on, look in the wave function. That's what it would say. And then you have to accept that they're parallel universes. But a normal guy in physics, he would say that, shut up and calculate, I want to hear about it, don't go the drain, don't go down the drain. That's Richard Feynman, by the way.
Doesn't this one, maybe I'm not understanding it, but doesn't the last one we were talking about sort of have another multiple world skill to it anyway, because we have that configuration space that we can't see or interact with? Which, how is that different than a many worlds type situation?
How is it deterministic?
Like the last one there says, we have the configuration space that we can't interact with. How is that different than a many worlds?
That's a good question. The many worlds people are saying that people in this field are in a state of chronic denial. they're really many worlds people.
That's just one of the states that they're in. There's a denial state and the accepted state, so they're in the undenial
world. Well, look at this picture here now. A many worlds guy would say, look, what is this black dot thing? Take it away. I don't need it. The wave function is here and here at the same time. That's common for both theories. Many worlds is without this dot, the boiled bone is with the dot. And many worlds guy will say, look at the wave function is here and here, therefore the two parallel universes.
So there's two dots.
Well, in the boiled bone theory, you have one dot, which sort of gets into one of those. But you still have the wave function left. And you're saying, I'm hard pressed to see why, the wave function should be unobservable, shouldn't correspond to something in reality. Why is it postulated to not correspond to anything, which I can touch on the field and so on? I mean, these are the issues which are hard. I mean, once again, we're getting out into blur things with words and so on. But I think this, this piece is, I think is good. But I think that the more reasonable criticism that we have two different spaces in this theory. It's about corpus in space, and there's a wave function configuration space. It's a damn strange theory to have two different spaces. So already there, I'm sort of starting to be unhappy with this theory.
In any of these theories, or in quantum theory in general, how does it get decided where you end up, where do you collapse, in which state, where do you choose to put your dot, which world do you end up in?
So,
I mean, you have a superposition of, in the easiest system, two states.
Yeah.
And in the last theory, you decide, or it is decided, to put the dot in that one.
No.
In the...
Here the dot is where the dot is determined by exact equations. Now, in very short-time notation, this is the equation. So it's exactly like in Newtonian physics. It's not that I'm putting in the dot somewhere. It's like in Newtonian physics. It's pushed around, moving around, like that. The wave function is just the solution of the Schrödinger equation. So everything is very exact. I don't have any freedom left to put in dots here and there, no. This theory is telling me everything from the very start.
Okay, so that's the only one that does that. The rest is probability. There's no probability left in this?
The probability. So, and maybe I could finish with this. This is something I did for my PhD thesis, because it's a good question now. This is the Broad-Bone thesis, the deterministic theory. Why do I see the quantum statistics? Why do I see certain kind of probabilities? Because it's a deterministic theory. So let me try to explain it. I had an empty on this last time, which was very useful.
So you
emptied
it,
huh?
Yeah, for
the
class.
Yeah. Let me go back here. This is like a two-dimensional box now. Something can move around inside here. So this theory is having an evolution of the wave function. It's sort of evolving, and this configuration moving around like this inside the box. So, oh, there's already one in here. Okay. So first, I tell you now, I'm going to put the chalk in this corner, and you know where it is, right? We have a probability distribution. I mean, if you would like to bet on this, you would say it's in that corner. And I do it like that. That's correspond to this motion going around. Where's the chalk now? You don't know, right? No, you don't. You can't see it, right? Okay.
You're exhibiting
it towards that part. So if I'm doing that, I'm stirring around, and my initial, so in the beginning I knew it was somewhere over here, but I'm stirring it around, my probability distribution will sort of evolve and become sort of more uniform, because I don't know where it is. According to the Broad-Bone theory, like in this case, you can put in the particle wherever you like. And if I consider many, many of these boxes, I can put it in, for example, according to that distribution, or all the ones in the corner, then the probability distribution would look something like that, zero everywhere else. I can choose any distribution in this theory. Quantum theory, on the other hand, is very precise about this. You have to put in your particles according to this probability distribution. So if I have many boxes, many particles has to be over there. Many particles has to be over there. Very, very few there, and no one over here. So quantum theory is telling me exactly how to do that. But in this theory, I see no reason why I should choose that distribution. So let's start with a different distribution.
So if this deterministic one, is that similar to the butterfly fluttering the wing causes a hurricane concept?
It's similar. This is also a chaotic system. It has chaos, but so let's evolve this. Like when I was turning around this chalk box here now, let's try to evolve the probability distribution. Of course, everything is exact. We have equations to do this in the theory. And let's see what happens. Well, it doesn't look very much the same. A little bit maybe. Peak there. It's zero here and zero there. So a little bit like that. But after a certain time, it starts looking very much alike. So now, if you notice here, the wave function has come back to its original shape. This shape is completely dissimilar. It has evolved into something which looks like a wave function, or like the quantum mechanical probabilities. So it tells you that when you shake things around, you get quantum theory. This is a relaxation process. Basically, what's being done here was Ludwig Boltzmann was doing to classical physics and arriving at thermodynamics and statistical physics. It's the same thing. So here you arrive at the equilibrium state, what's called the equilibrium state, and that's the quantum mechanical state. So this is how you understand probabilities. If you begin by putting in your particles according to that distribution, shake it around, you get quantum theory in the end. So if you look at, sort of, make position measurements in the end, this theory will tell you the same thing as quantum theory. This is how you understand probabilities. There's a research program which is done by a guy here, Anthony Valentini, about what happens when you have non-equilibrium in this theory, non-quantum probabilities. That's a possibility here. So this is also going beyond quantum theory. Even though you may be unhappy with this theory, it's actually telling you that, you know, there's at least a possibility of non-equilibrium, non-quantum statistics. What is happening when you have non-quantum statistics? And there's some pretty drastic effects. It would be the end of my first part of the talk, as I planned it, but it is the end of my whole talk, unfortunately. You can understand Bell inequalities very much, like in terms of non-equilibrium distributions, which is rather interesting, I would say. So that's sort of floating out in the questions now, so that's good. And I think I end here. So.
Maybe two questions and we'll break for lunch.
No questions.
Right here. If you say the act of measuring is what blasts a wave function and makes an event occur, that kind of implies like we need to be around looking at things for things to happen, right?
Yeah, so now let's place ourselves within a certain interpretation. So now you're here.
Yes.
You're also a little bit here. I mean, it's not.
So
it depends on
you're not many worlds, because then you're not collapsing. But
yeah. If you think that way, then like let's say we're not around, but nothing can ever happen. You just got like that wave function space just sitting there waiting. Mm-hmm. So let's say at the beginning of the universe, when no one was around to ever measure or look at things, how did the universe like how what's your perception of time? Because nothing can ever happen. How did anything
there's a famous quote by John Bell, the square guy was over here at the beginning.
Yeah.
He was saying that did the universe wait for guys with PhDs to collapse the wave function? the real quote is much more weird, but it's a little bit long and it's very nice. But so that's exactly the kinds of questions. I mean, we have all these nice heroes in physics. Pounding pop. But I mean, as a physicist, you need to forget about that for a while and think that, oh, okay, these are great guys, but I'm going to be skeptical because that's the essence of science. You ask questions like you're doing here. Yeah. You say, what do you mean collapse the wave function? Are we supposed to go circles around to do that? Well, what happened before, you know, the first 3 minutes in the universe? I mean, how do I understand things like this? There's no observer. The God collapsing away. I mean, what are you saying? So, I mean, so indeed, people trying to do quantum cosmology, which means trying to treat the early universe quantum mechanically, they're asking, they're running to these questions. What is meant by quantum theory in the early universe? How do you collapse the wave function? Where's my measurement of hypothesis, which seems to be so fundamental in the Copenhagen interpretation? And they're, of course, not satisfied.
One more question?
So is the hidden variable kind of because of the uncertainty principle, you can't measure where the dot is, but it actually is in one spot, but you just can't measure where it is? Is that
the uncertainty principle is a feature of equilibrium here. If you have this non-quantum probabilities, you can see exactly where the dot is. So there's some things with properties of quantum theory which you get in this theory only when you have quantum mechanical distributions. So when you have this equilibrium state, there's a lot of things you can know. And I mean, it's precisely as
Also, as it goes out of equilibrium, you can see then.
Yes. The problem is that Boltzmann were coining the term heat death. And that's something, entropy is always increasing, so you have this process, relaxation process, everything goes to a certain state, and then it stays there, and that's called the heat death. You have exactly the same type of thing in this theory. Once you get to the quantum theory, it sort of stays there. You don't get back. It could happen as a fluctuation or something, and that's what you say there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Hans. Round of
applause. Okay, so we will have lunch now. Johannes will hopefully contribute time to join us. And if you have any questions,
is it free lunch for me?
Yes.
It's at 1 o'clock, folks. T-shirts are for sale and I'm here as well while you're waiting online.
Nice
t-shirts.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. So you should answer for it.